I think utilizing clean pools is obviously, it's very easy to administer, especially in a competition environment. You just have to stick the weights on. And also it's biomechanical similarity to what you're about to do on the platform is pretty high, right? So I think its use is warranted. However, you have to be aware it might have positive effects on some individuals, but it can also have some negative effects.
All right, welcome to Evidence Strong Show, Sham. It's my pleasure to have you for the third time, first person ever to achieve that. And today we are talking post-activation potentiation. But before we start, could you please briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah, firstly, thank you very much for having me on for the hat trick, Alex. Very much appreciated. So my name is Sham Chavda. I'm the program lead at Middlesex University London Sport Institute for the Masters of Strength and Conditioning Distance Education. And I also work as the lead performance scientist and coach at British Weightlifting.
Excellent. We will be talking about your latest paper. So the title is Effect of Post-Activation Potentiation on Weightlifting Performance and Endocrinological Responses. So let's start with what post-activation potentiation is in the context of Olympic weightlifting.
Yeah, sure. So post-activation potentiation is essentially using conditioning stimulus that helps elicit greater neural drive and force output in a specific muscle fiber. And actually, probably more recently, the terminology has changed, and it is probably a reflection I have on this paper, is the term of post-activation performance enhancement. So PAPE as opposed to PAT. So in the instance of weightlifting, we were looking at utilizing a conditioning stimulus that may help us elicit greater forces and power output during a weightlifting movement. So specifically, we wanted to understand if a supramaximal clean pull at 120% of someone's 1RM clean would impact the force and barbell mechanics of a clean performed at 90%. And also whether that 120% clean pull would alter any endocrinological responses, as heavy loading has also been posited to acutely increase things like serum testosterone, which may enhance the force production of an individual.
How did you design the study?
So this study was a collaborative study with our biomedical team over at Middlesex, and primarily was conducted by two excellent MSc students, you know, a little while ago now, one of them being Dr. Angela Sorensen, of course, who you've had on the podcast before, fantastic coach and researcher. So essentially, the way we set this up, it was a randomized controlled experiment involving 8 ranked collegiate weightlifters, and they attended 2 separate testing days, of course, with the order session randomized. So in both sessions, we standardized the warm-up, which was essentially clean-related barbell warm-up, followed by working up to 80% of 1RM clean performance, performing 3 reps at each load, and these were clustered by around 30 seconds between reps and 2 to 3 minutes between sets. So very typical kind of session type warm-up as you would expect in training. So the 2 sessions we had, one of them was a control and the other was the experimental session. So in the control session, following the warm-up, the athletes performed 3 clean lifts at 90% of 1RM with 1 minute between each repetition. And this session allowed us to establish like a baseline measurement for ground reaction forces of the clean, as well as the barbell mechanic measured by integrated force pace and motion capture. And it also allowed us to obtain baseline endocrinological status via saliva samples. On the experimental session, they'd come in, they'd do their normal warm-up up to that 80%, but then following that 80%, they performed clean pulls. So they performed the clean pulls doing a single repetition at 100 to 120% of 1RM. And this was followed by a 3-minute recovery period. So the conditioning stimulus was 120% 1RM clean pull. The time frame following that was 3 minutes. And then they conducted 3 repetitions at 90% on the force plates with the motion capture. And in both cases, during the control and the experimental, we took the saliva samples before the warm-up and 15 minutes after the last clean performance.
Who did you invite to the study?
It was a very small sample that we used. So arguably, it was quite underpowered to be very open and transparent, but the level were regional to national weightlifters. But when you look at the subject statistics, you can see the spread is quite large, particularly with relative strength and also half being male, half being female. So I think the relative strength spread was cleaning between 1 to 1.5 times body weight, which relative to other studies that I've published and other people have published is probably on the lower end of the relative strength ratio, right? Quickly going back to only using 8 participants, it becomes very difficult in our where we're based to get a higher sample size of people who are familiar with the clean. But what it did allow us to do, and I think this is really important, it allowed us to take a step forward to try and analyze individuals and discuss that a little bit more. And I think that becomes even more important, particularly when looking at responses within weightlifting and weightlifters, because it is an individual sport. And when you look at some of the potentiating research, it also suggests that there often is an individual response that we need to look out for. So I think that was a nice opportunity to try and discuss and exploit that.
What did you measure?
Our biomedical team, they obtained testosterone and cortisol and the ratio between the two using saliva collected via swabs and for the kinetic measures, so the ground reaction forces. We used force plates where we extracted vertical peak force as well as the impulse of weighting one, which is essentially the first pull, the unweighting phase, which typically refers to the transition, and then weighting two, which typically refers to the second pull. And this is all vertical ground reaction forces. And along that, we had synchronized some motion capture to it so we could get some barbell information as well. And from that, we extracted vertical peak barbell height. And we looked at that as a ratio to the height of the actual athlete. So did they pull the bar higher, essentially? And we also looked at peak power of the barbell as well. So was there an ability to transfer all those ground reaction forces into the barbell following the conditioning stimulus?
The strong points are that you went with the clean quite high. 90% cleans are hard, even for weightlifters to execute. And you had force plates and motion capture, which are state-of-the-art tools to really look at what is going on in terms of forces during the movement. So that's awesome. The minus would be low sample size.
Yeah, of course. And I also think maybe the strength, the relative strengths within the group as well, I think was probably too widespread.
What have you found?
Yeah, so ultimately the group findings suggested there wasn't any difference between the control and the experimental, which is a shame because we always hope to find something. But what we did notice is that there were definitely subject-specific responses, meaning some did see positive changes, i.e. there was an increase in impulse and in peak force, but also some showed some negative changes, meaning that impulse and force actually reduced. And I think that goes back to what I mentioned earlier around the advantage of looking at individual responses is quite important and quite nice, particularly within an individual sport. But when we try to understand why we had these results, I think it comes down to a number of multiple factors, which I think is important to try and outline. So the first one, I think, is to do with the time frame following the conditioning activity of 120% clean pull. So we use 3 minutes. Now, potentially that might be too short to create a meaningful change across the board. But there was a reason why we chose 3 minutes, which we cover in the paper. And that tends to be your last warm-up lift prior to going on the platform in a competition would probably be around 2 to 3 minutes before you step out for your first lift. There has been some evidence that has suggested 3 minutes between clean attempts is actually more beneficial for enhancing force production. So we decided to go with that shortest time frame of 3 minutes. But also, if you think from a tactical perspective, if you have a group of athletes clustered together and there are changes occurring on the board, pushing your athlete later and later down the line in terms of getting on the platform, then maybe 3 minutes is probably about right. And of course, there's far more we can discuss around timings and future research moving forward. So we utilized 3 minutes, and that could be too short. And the influence this can have on the outcome is that during a heavy conditioning stimulus, the central nervous system recruits high threshold motor units, primarily type 2 muscle fibers, for increasing rate coding. And this is what allows us to develop that high amount of force, right? But if the time after the conditioning activity is too short, then of course, fatigue is going to kick in, which will then lead to a reduction in rate coding, reduced motor unit recruitment, and ultimately a decrement in the athlete's ability to produce force. So getting the timing is critical to utilize a heightened central nervous system potentiation. But of course, it is, and then you're going to get a reduction in performance. So it could be that the time frame was too short, and future research may want to look at time frames which are slightly longer. And, you know, we see that in some of our results, where some people did respond positively, some people didn't. But as a group, there wasn't any real significant difference.
I wanted to ask whether you found any differences between female and male athletes.
Yeah, so I think that wasn't something we looked at directly. But what I did look at in a little bit more detail after the publication and even during the process was actually whether the strength level would affect the outcomes. And I'll tie that back into male and female as well. And the reason we didn't compare male and female, although we could have, again, it's you're comparing four against four. So the conclusion we get from that probably isn't very generalizable, right? But when we looked at stronger individuals, they tended to show us, well, stronger individuals overall are able to exhibit higher contraction capabilities and produce more force, right? And because of that, they're more likely to elicit central and peripheral fatigue because of the absolute loading and the absolute forces that they're producing. So this increased fatigue might mask any potentiation, especially if you're using a 3-minute time frame. So they might need longer to recover, right? With a weaker individual, they're not going to be producing as much force, and the absolute load they're lifting is going to be less. Even the relative load's going to be less as well, of course. But they may also have lower type 2 fiber type composition. They'll have reduced neuromuscular efficiency and lower motor unit recruitment. So they actually might need less time between the conditioning activity and the performance measure. So maybe 3 minutes would be okay in this instance. But I think if we look at this in a broader perspective, our results showed that the strongest male, so coming back round to comparing men and female, the strongest male had the most positive effect as well as the strongest female. So when we looked at individuals and how they responded, because I wanted to use this to implement with some of my lifters, the strongest male, strongest relative male, had the most positive changes across all those measures. The strongest female also had the most positive changes across the measures. And when I kind of rank how each individual, based on their relative strength, responded, the females seem to have followed a pattern that I kind of expected. So the strongest one had the most response, the next one was the second strongest, and then third and fourth were just flipped over. So the fourth strongest or the weakest female actually had the third most positive responses compared to the third strongest. But when we look at the males, it was very random. So the strongest male had the most responses, and then after that it was no responses, then after that it was lots of responses, and after that it was no responses. So it kind of explains why we had an overall finding of no differences between the control and the experiment. But when you take a bit of a deeper dive into the information, it does give us a little bit more of an idea around the potential of the effect of strength, and also potentially how that distributes itself within males and females.
Would you have any comments about endocrinological responses?
Yeah, so the idea behind this was that it's been positive that having increased serum testosterone increases your force output, but also doing high intensity activities can also alter your testosterone cortisol ratio. So if it's too intense, then of course your cortisol is going to start to kick up, right? And the thought was, well, will this conditioning activity keep our hormonal status either unchanged, or will it positively influence it and be a potential factor as to why we might be able to produce more force or not? So that's the reason we kind of went into it. And unfortunately, kind of nothing came out of that. There wasn't anything we could really, really discuss on the testosterone and cortisol side other than we didn't, or the conditioning activity didn't seem to alter it.
All right, so let's bring it all together. So for the coaches, what they should take out of the study?
So I think utilizing clean pools is obviously, it's very easy to administer, especially in a competition environment. You just have to stick the weights on. And also it's by biomechanical similarity to what you're about to do on the platform is pretty high, right? So I think its use is warranted. However, you have to be aware it might have positive effects on some individuals, but it can also have some negative effects. So I think it's important to understand what your athlete is used to or what they prefer during times where tactically the board starts to change. So you need to make a decision. Do they do a reduced load and do a power variant, which would also be incredibly interesting to study and look at a potential, whether that potentiates to go on the platform. Or do they like to do a pull instead, which in that case, you can look at varying intensities to see where an athlete is able to keep or maintain their performance or maybe even optimize it. So it is very individualized based off our findings. Again, that supports that narrative of it is individualized. If it works for some, but they don't like doing a heavy clean pull and they prefer doing a lighter power clean, you're probably not going to sell to them, do 120% clean pull before you go out on the 3 minutes before you go out on the platform. It's probably not a good sell, right? So I think it certainly depends on what the athlete and coach kind of agree on and whether they find a utility in it or not. But I think the bigger thing to take into consideration is regardless of the negative effects that the clean pull had on some of the lifters, they still all managed to clean the weight. So actually the outcome was still the same. It's just that they didn't produce as much force. So they actually did it with less force production and in more of a negative or more fatigued state. So you do wonder if you were to go heavier than 90%, would that impact the actual outcome of the performance measure, which is making a successful lift? And in the context of weightlifting, that's what matters. So irrespective of, oh, my peak force went down, or who cares, you made the lift. And that is quite important from a scientific perspective, where we're trying to find these nuances to optimize performance. Of course, this absolutely matters. And I think maybe coaches might want to try and experiment within their own environment, maybe using things like, you know, measuring velocity, for example, if they don't have access to force plates.
Last two questions. The first one is one piece of wisdom from you as an expert to all the coaches.
Oh, I definitely wouldn't call myself an expert, but I will keep striving towards that. So I think if I could pass on one piece of wisdom, I think people should stay curious and where possible, test your hunches and your hypothesis, because curiosity means, you know, we're keen to develop and we want to better understand our practices. And I think that's really important to understand the why behind what we do. And don't be afraid to be challenged on your thoughts and practices as well, as often or not, that's where kind of growth occurs. And as coaches, practitioners, as scientists, I believe that's where we should be kind of placing ourselves, in a place of what do we need to understand or what don't I understand and how can I develop my understanding of that area? Because then we grow as a scientific community to then be able to share, you know, great information, and we can pick and choose what works in our own environments. Because at the end of the day, we don't just do what we do because we enjoy it, but it's also because we want to get the best out of our athletes. So being challenged on our practices and following up on our curiosities means not only do we develop, but also it means as a proxy, our athletes will benefit from it as well.
Awesome. Thank you. Last question is where people can find you if they want to ask a question or follow your work. Where should they go?
Yeah, sure. So people can catch me on socials or via email. My email is s.chavda@mdx.ac.uk. And my socials are shy_2tweet. That's for X. And Instagram is coach_chavda.
Right, Sham, thank you so much for today and for the last 3 years.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much for the hat trick opportunity. Very much appreciate it. And I think you're doing a great job with disseminating some really useful information out there with these great practitioners and scientists that you've had on the podcast. So thank you.
Thank you, Sham.
Cheers.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,